This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we'll talk to Andy Downs, the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics over in Fort Wayne. Indiana General Assembly is at the midpoint, and they're now going to take a look at what is going to happen in the rest of the session, and we'll get some idea from Andy about that. Also, Meg Roman, who is the executive director of the Miller Beach Arts and Creative District, will join us to talk about the district's explosive growth in the last couple of years and what is in store for 2018, that is, once the snow goes away. And we'll also bring you two comments from people who are involved in the Nurse Family Partnership here in Lake County. We'll talk with Paulette Maxey and a new Northwest Indiana mom about the project. That and more coming up, but first the news. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Indiana General Assembly is halfway through the 2018 session, and they've covered a lot of ground and still a lot more to cover. And let's check in now with Andy Downs. He's the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics over in Fort Wayne. And as always, Andy, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you very much for having me. I always like coming up to the Northwest.
Well, it's really snowy this time of year now, but you know that's the way it is when you're over in this corner of the state, so close to Lake Michigan. One thing we note for sure that it's certainly not been very snowy to speak of for this General Assembly. They've had a rather sparse agenda, kind of kept it to the basics, but they seem to have gotten an awful lot of things at least moved from one house to the other. And we should mention that today, Tuesday, as well as yesterday, Monday, were very important days for this session. Outline why there are these deadlines that the lawmakers have to face.
We have to remember that the process they follow is one that you and I are supposed to be able to follow and participate in. We actually are encouraged to go to the meetings, go to the hearings, to communicate with our legislators. And if they didn't publish a calendar, we wouldn't know when to contact people. So the process is actually fairly straightforward for a bill to become a law. It has to be introduced in one chamber. It goes through three readings in that chamber or three votes in that row. Two votes technically in that chamber, and then moves over to the other chamber and does the exact same thing. And when we start talking about the second half of the session, what that means is that bills have to make it out of the first chamber, the chamber of origin, by a certain deadline that varies from session to session, and get over to the second one. If it doesn't, then that bill theoretically is dead. And so we are now passing the halfway point where bills have to make it over to the other chamber. This, like I said, is so that you and I can actually pay attention and follow along. And I encourage people, go to the General Assembly's website, iga.in.gov. There is a lot of really helpful information there.
Now, let's first take the House of Representatives. They had their work done on Monday, and now we kind of wait to see what happens in the Indiana Senate today. But there are a number of bills that have made it from the House over to the Senate now, and some of these, of course, have a great impact on Northwest Indiana as well as the rest of the state. Let's focus in first, Andy, about the ones that we here in the region are the most concerned about, or the ones that we hear the most about. In particular, the House bill that has made it over, House Bill 1374, which is sponsored by Ed Soliday from Valparaiso. It's one that deals with how the financing is going to be arranged for the proposed South Shore Line work. Tell us about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when we look at how much money we spend on transportation, it's a huge amount of money, and there, of course, is a desire to spend even more. But Indiana has long been recognized as the crossroads, and crossroads, people think, just highways. But it's more than that. It's about the ports, it's about rail, it's about the South Shore more specifically, and we sort of keep adding things into the mix little by little, and every now and then what we really need to do is sort of come back and take a look at the totality of how things are happening. So this particular bill, which, as you pointed out, sponsored by Ed Soliday, deals with financing and actually creates an entire new part of the Indiana Code that's an attempt to rewrite various statutes and put them into one place in terms of the Indiana Finance Authority so that theoretically these things might be done a little easier and in a way that's a little easier for us to understand as average folks.
Now, we know, too, that this just deals mainly with the state funding. There's a whole separate federal government aspect of the funding in this, and that hasn't even been taken up by Congress or anybody in Washington, D.C. yet, other than just discussed, I'm sure. But this all has to start, I guess, first with the groundwork that has to be laid so that the state funding, wherever it may happen to come from, is going to go to the right places.
Exactly. And today, so many of the transportation projects, whether it's rail or highway or even air, involve some sort of blending of financing from the federal level as well as the state level. And you know, sometimes you get very lucky and it's something like an 80-20 mix, 80% of it covered by the feds, 20% has to be covered through the state. Those, obviously, we like those because it's our tax dollars and other people's tax dollars coming to Indiana. But you still have to come up with the 20%. And there usually are timetables by which you have to spend the money. Not only is the South Shore one of these things that we're trying to figure out how to expand and make more useful. I know I love it. I never drive into Chicago any longer. I take the South Shore.
Yeah.
But there are other projects down in Indianapolis, for example. They're trying to develop a better public transportation system as well. And then there's always the talk of high-speed rail running across the northern part of the state. We'll see where that goes. That, I like to say that has the longest shot, I guess, of the things that are being discussed. So we'll have to wait and see what happens.
And we know that one in particular is certainly of interest over your way there over in Fort Wayne, because we know that the part of that route that would be proposed by the high-speed rail would end up going to over to Fort Wayne and then points to the south of there. So it's a very, very expanded plan compared to just what we face here at the South Shore. But just the same, we're all waiting to see what happens, and this is what's going to come about, to be sure.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other measures, or several of the other measures, actually are ones I'll let you take up here that deal with a number of different subjects, like workforce development and handguns and that sort of thing. Fill us in, if you will, on some of the measures that have made it out of the House, now headed to the Senate.
Yeah, the session was described as a workforce session, and that's in part because that's part of what the governor talked about, and that's in part because the leaders in the two chambers were trying to give the session some focus. Virtually every year there's something that gives the session focus. Obviously, in the budget year, it's easy to say it's the budget that provides the focus. But in the other years, and even in budget years, sometimes there are other things. And workforce development was one of those things. The issue with workforce development is that there are a number of entities that provide workforce development, either oversight or provision of services and provision of revenue. And it's, some would argue, not working quite the way we would like to see it worked. Keep in mind that right now we're looking at some really low unemployment in the state of Indiana, but we're still trying to attract new businesses here. And the governor and some other people are saying we need to be able to respond faster. We need to make sure that our employees, our residents are ready to work as soon as those jobs get here. And there's a belief that it's just too convoluted right now. And so the hope was to try and get all of these things worked out. It is the legislative session, so we never say that anything is done until it's signed by the governor. There are some people who think that we still might see some workforce development legislation coming out. There are other people who say, no, it's not going to be that. Instead, it'll be some sort of a study committee
mm-hmm.
that sets us up for doing that in a budget year, which is really the good time to do it because so much of that is contingent upon money coming from the budget. So this may have just been the appetizer, so to speak, to get us ready for actually doing something next year.
Okay. Now we talk about handguns. I know that one measure just made it out of the House and headed to the Senate here. It deals with the licensing of handguns in Indiana, and that's a change from the past. So I guess it's something that if it does become law, we'll have to get used to.
Yeah, it's idea of legislation, or excuse me, the idea of permits, et cetera, it's an interesting thing. There are a lot of people who are fans of the idea of a lifetime permit, for example. There are other people who have the opposite opinion and say, no, we should actually shorten the number of years that someone can, that somebody doesn't have to come back and re-up for their license. There's also an issue of reciprocity that's happening at the federal level, and that's playing a bit of a role here in Indiana. Basically, though, yesterday, the House did vote to remove a fee for a lifetime carry permit and increases the number of years of the current permit from 4 years to 5 years. And so those are the two big things. A couple of other things have fallen off the way. For example, permanent lifetime for virtually everyone. I think I'm oversimplifying, but there was somebody who was a big fan of basically removing the need for a permit of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're looking at right now is something that is a little more narrowly tailored so that there's a no fee for a lifetime carry permit. And if you get a permit in the conventional way, it's a 5-year permit instead of a 4-year permit.
One of the bill that was sponsored by State Representative Charlie Brown of Gary dealt with the problem of not enough pharmacies, and particularly in low-income resident areas. And that's what his measure, House Bill 1382, was all about. And he's asked for a lot of more study into the idea that residents should be sure that they are able to get their prescription filled regardless of where they happen to live.
Yeah, the idea of deserts, that's not a new one. We've talked about food deserts for a while.
Right.
There's been some attempt to address those. But when you think about areas of the entire state, you can easily find areas that are underserved in a lot of ways. And pharmacies would be a good example of that. You know, some of us live in places where you can find a pharmacy, you know, within a half a mile or a mile of where you're living. In other places, not at all. But this is one of those things. In Indiana, we very much believe, at least we say we believe, that businesses should be free to do what they want to do, when they want to do it. In other words, be successful and start your business, be an entrepreneur. And we don't want to put limitations on businesses. But the reality is there are some places that are underserved. And the question is, when does the government step in to try and deal with that underserved issue? I think it was very smart of Representative Brown to go for a study committee here. No one was going to be interested in passing legislation that mandates that the state somehow provide pharmacy coverage in places where it's not, because there would have been a fight. Are these urban areas that are the deserts, or are they rural areas that are the deserts? And that just would not have gone well. So I think this is a good approach to it. We'll have to see what happens, though, because this is, in many respects, people theoretically asking the government to be much more proactive about something than it normally is when it comes to the economic sphere.
We're talking with Andy Downs, who is the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics in Fort Wayne, about the bills that have made it out of the 2018 General Assembly session in the House. There were some education-related bills, too. I know about school discipline and diplomas that have made it over there. Tell us a little bit about those.
Yeah, the diploma one might be the one that gets the most attention.
Mm-hmm.
People right now are saying this is something that had to happen because of the change from No Child Left Behind to Every Student Succeeds the Most. That's the bill that took the place of No Child Left Behind at the federal level. And the states basically had to make some kind of an adjustment. One of the issues was how states were scored in terms of graduation rates. Indiana, in terms of our classifications of high school diplomas, had some issues that we needed to address. And there were competing theories about how to approach this. There were some people who wanted to make changes right away, very quickly, did not get input from educators, you know, the professionals, the way they should. And other people said, well, no, these changes are actually what the job market is looking for, and these are good changes. We'll have to wait and see how they play out, which is the usual case when major changes to education happen. Folks who really want to be looking at are folks like Bob Boehning. He had a bill in particular, 1426, that was about the diplomas. So that's a bill for people to look at. One of the things that people like about that bill, not that people don't like the parts I've mentioned already, is that there is an attempt to create basically a diploma for students who are learning disabled, who have cognitive disabilities, so that they are actually earning a diploma as opposed to earning a certificate or something else. The diploma would be the way for them to actually suddenly be qualified for a number of jobs that they're automatically written off from because the job says you need a high school diploma. So there's some good and some bad in there, but it's one that people who, especially if they have children who are in school right now in the lower grades, they should take a look at 1426 and start following this one pretty carefully,
mm-hmm.
or at a minimum, contact the superintendent/principal/favorite teacher, whoever, you know, whatever you want to say, in their public schools and talk with them about this one. It's an important one, very, very important.
I know one other education-related measure that has been up for debate and has been moving through the General Assembly is one that the school boards, not only in Gary but also in Muncie, are very, very concerned about. And it's about a change that would come about in education with the takeover districts that had problems and what the state says they want to do, and in particular, who's going to represent these people on their relative boards that they have. Some of these people are really up in arms because these elected boards don't have much say.
It's true, and you think about it, the school boards throughout the entire state have lost say in what they do because the state took over funding of K-12 education. Now, on the one hand, it was good the state took that over, but at the same time, local school boards lost some flexibility in what they want to do or could do regarding funding. But that's eroded further when you start talking about the state, quote, taking over a school district. And obviously, Gary and Muncie are the two that people are focused on right now.
Right.
With the goal of universities actually taking them over, limiting further, the argument is, input from the public into what's going to happen in those school districts. Obviously, whenever a takeover has to take place, whether it's an individual school or a school district, I personally believe it's imperative that whoever does that takeover be in constant communication with the people who are served by that school or that school district. This will be tricky because a lot of people will see the takeover as needing to sort of right the ship financially and just begin making changes that will be viewed as detrimental without getting much public input.
Well, we talk about the measures that have made it from one house over to the other chamber and will be reviewed over in the Indiana Senate now as they move ahead. Well, how about the bills that didn't make it? There's some interesting ones that are out there that have kind of fallen by the wayside this year.
Yeah, and the one that some people will be disappointed by is the cold beer sales, but then they'll be happy because the Sunday sales bill is moving, so that one's fallen by the wayside. It's unlikely to see a legalization of medical marijuana. That's another one that probably won't become law anytime soon. Then there are still in the sort of serious range are things like the hate crimes legislation. That's fallen by the wayside. And actually a bill that was going to change smoking age to 21, that one died as well. Some things that were maybe not quite as some people would say important. There was a bill introduced that was going to require the Colts to refund money if any of the Colts players knelt during the national anthem.
Oh,
you know, there are always things like that almost always end up falling by the wayside. So that's another one that people are probably happy to see not move forward. Other people, I'm sure, will be disappointed. And then there was a bill that would have actually pretty much become a total ban on abortion in the state of Indiana. That one's also not moving. There are a number of social conservatives who are upset about that. And one of the arguments for the bill not moving forward has been that the bill was obviously in conflict with current law and current court rulings. And the people who like this bill are saying, but we have a different court now, and we want a court challenge. We want a bill to work its way up to the Supreme Court. And Indiana's as good a place as any for that bill to come from. But that's probably not going to happen this time around either.
Can you give us an idea of what you see as are going to be the measures that to watch here in this second half of the General Assembly session?
It becomes more complicated to watch things in the second half of the session because people can start amending things into bills. But and this is, I think, maybe the most important thing for people to know. I was talking with some professional lobbyists last week, and it seems like every session there is at least one thing that sort of blows up, and sometimes we know what it's going to be, sometimes we don't. But there's something that blows up, it lets the legislature let off some steam, and then they sort of get back to productivity. We haven't seen that yet, and maybe this will be a session where that doesn't happen or doesn't need to happen. So it could be that the dynamics of the legislature itself are what change cause us the things to happen in the second half of the session. So that's one thing that I think people should watch out for, just that. And then I'd go back to the diploma bill, the education bill that I mentioned earlier. I think that's an important one for people to keep an eye on, in part because we spend so much time and effort on education, not only in terms of resources, but the legislature working on things, Department of Education working on things. Anytime people start talking about education bills that are moving, I think they're worth watching because they can make a pretty significant difference in people's lives.
Andy, thank you very much for being with us and giving us a clue here on how this first half of the session went and what to look for in the second half of the 2018 session.
It is always a pleasure being on. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Andy Downs is the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Fort Wayne. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Miller Beach Arts and Creative District has enjoyed what has been described as a meteoric rise, and there's good reason for that. One of the people who has followed along, I guess, in making sure that the district has grown so fast and grown so well is Meg Roman. She is the founding executive director, a native of Gary, and she's been very much involved in the project from the very beginning, and she's with us here on Regionally Speaking. Meg, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, for folks that are not necessarily familiar with the Miller Beach Arts and Creative District, give us just a quick history lesson, please.
Great. Well, we were founded in 2001 as an all-volunteer organization, and we are a 501c3 nonprofit. I became the first employee and first executive director in 2014, so I was not part of the founding, but I am the first paid employee.
Uh-huh.
We are otherwise a 99% all-volunteer organization, and we try to have as eclectic a offering in the arts and culture with a primary goal of bringing about economic development for the city of Gary and the Northwest Indiana region as a whole.
Now, I know that you, as the head of the organization, have a great volunteer base to work with. These are people that are really, really involved in the community and in the particular in the arts in the community, and they oversee an awful number of projects every single year and some very important ones too. Give us an idea of some of the big projects that all these volunteers help you on every year.
Yes, we are very blessed to have an 18-person volunteer board and hundreds of volunteers, and they help us put together 30 to 40 events every year. We went from having, the first year we had a couple hundred people attending, and this year, or last year, mm-hmm. we had almost 8,000 attendees at our event.
Wow, wow.
So we also, in addition to doing art exhibits and concerts, dance performances in our 6,000-square-foot gallery on Lake Street in the Miller neighborhood of Gary, Indiana. We also run the Farmers Market, which is held May through October at the corner of Lake Street and Highway 12, right by the Miller train station. And we are the backbone organization for Legacy Foundation's Neighborhood Spotlight, which was started with the Miller and Hobart neighborhoods and has since expanded to the Emerson neighborhood of Gary and Griffith are now involved. Mm-hmm. And it's all just to bring good events back to the region that people want to go to, getting people on the streets so that people realize this is a vibrant and growing area. There's lots of great things to do here. And sometimes, unfortunately, we have to go against reputations that are usually not necessarily fair. So we're just trying to show people that there's wonderful things to do here. 18 new businesses have opened up just on Lake Street, in Miller, mm-hmm. and many more around the region because there are cultural events and things for people to do, and it's really working.
Now, besides some of the regular events that are coming up here in 2018, are there any new ones or ones that people should know about to watch for?
Well, we will be launching our Black History Month celebration this coming Friday, the 9th, with collections of all kinds of mixed media art celebrating the African American experience, paintings, photography, textiles, items that people have collected. And we will be having a film highlighting a collaboration between Julius Rosenwald, a Jewish American businessman who joined forces with Booker T. Washington to help build 5,000 schools and support major African-American artists such as W.E.B. Du Bois and Langston Hughes. That film will be showing on Saturday, February 24th at 6:30. Other than that, we will be having our annual sandcastle competition this August.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be doing art showcases for students from Lighthouse Charter Schools and hopefully some of the schools in Miller. This year we're going to launch our very first plein air art event where artists will be creating works of art outside, and they'll be doing that throughout the day, and then that evening there will be a reception and a sale of that art. So that's an event we hope will grow through the years and bring lots of people from outside of the area here. We'll be celebrating Poetry Month with a poetry slam, and we will have our sacred arts tour again with the Tibetan monks who come and build a beautifully intricate, colorful sand mandala on the floor of our art center, and they also do several cultural events throughout the week that they're here with a drum circle and Tibetan art with children where they have art classes. So that would be our fifth year, and it's proven to be a very popular event.
That's great. Now, Meg, if there's anyone that would like to keep track of what's happening, what's going to be happening there at the Miller Beach Arts and Creative District, how can they find out?
Well, our Facebook page, we're Miller Beach Arts on Facebook. And we also have our website, which is millerbeacharts.org. Those are the two main places to look. Mm-hmm. We're also on Twitter and Instagram.
Well, that's great. You have a complete social media presence out there, which as it should be. So it's great to know that there are so many places where somebody can keep track of what's happening and know coming up what's going to be happening as well, too, there in the community of Miller Beach. Meg Roman is the executive director of the Miller Beach Arts and Creative District. A lot of great things have happened in recent years there with the Arts and Creative District. A lot more coming up here, even beginning in 2018. And we thank you very much for taking some time to talk today on Originally Speaking about this. And the best of luck, and we'll look forward to the great programs coming up here during Black History Month.
Thank you so much. We're looking forward to seeing you all there.
You're listening to Originally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
Gary was the place you went to shop, and when it was a very successful community. We either drove there, my parents drove us there, or when we got a little older, we would just take the bus to downtown Gary. And there was every kind of shop you could think of. And at Christmas time, it was shoulder to shoulder walking up to down the street doing Christmas shopping. It was thriving. I grew up in a Lake Station, which it was East Gary when I grew up in it. Originally, it was Lake Station back in the 1800s and early 1900s, and then they changed their name to East Gary when, you know, the mills were starting to go, and they wanted the executives to move there, so they changed it. Then when things got bad in Gary, they changed it back to Lake Station. I thought that is very telling. It was a typical suburban kind of neighborhood. It was very working class. In fact, there were going to high school there. Everybody's parents made about the same amount of money. They worked in the mills. So in that way, it was probably different than a lot of other places because none of us were aspiring to be the rich kid in school. There were no rich kids in school. Patrick and I were married in 1966, and we moved to Miller in 1967, and we moved with a young baby. At that time, Miller was thriving. The downtown area had every kind of store you can think of. It was jewelry stores and bookstores and coffee shops and dress shops and Jack Spratt's ice cream shop, which drew people from all over. And it was the funnel to the beach. I mean, hundreds of people would come to the beach during the summer from all over. It started to change really in the 70s, and with so many things, early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, with all of the things that were going on nationally and locally. You know, the war had an impact on the economy, the Vietnam War. The mills were at their heights, and then started, you know, the economy was changing, the technology was changing so that less people were needed in the mills. And the whole suburban sprawl had an impact on little downtowns like Miller. It happened everywhere in the country, and it certainly happened here in Indiana with the other small communities. So at some point, there weren't a lot of businesses on the street, and those that were weren't thriving. A lot of the people left. They moved to Munster. That's how Munster got built. And the people who stayed are still here. But the whole dynamics of the community changed. The money went with them. You know, Munster's a thriving town. Maryville is in much better shape than Gary. So, yeah, that's the impact. If Gary doesn't thrive, the rest of the area doesn't thrive. And I think that is critically important. We can't have part of our population barely surviving. The city of Gary has all the infrastructure, you know, the steel mills. It has so much going for it. We can't ignore it. It's like somebody in your family who has cancer, and you're just going to ignore them because it's not going to affect you. Well, it is going to affect you. We all need to be good neighbors, and it's not just in Gary and Lake County, but in Porter County in Indiana. As a country, we have to not be so polarized because nobody's moving ahead.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu.
Julia Cook-Jones is a new mother of almost a three-month-old baby, and she is one of many success stories in the Nurse Family Partnership, which is set up by Goodwill and Central and Southern Indiana. With us, we have not only Julia Cook-Jones with us, but we have Paulette Maxey. She's the Director of Operations for the Nurse Family Partnership. Ladies, thank you for being with us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having us.
First off, Paulette, if you will, please explain what the Nurse Family Partnership is.
Sure. Nurse Family Partnership is a national program that is nurse-led. Here in Indiana, it's implemented by Goodwill Industries in conjunction with both Central and Southern Indiana, as well as Michiana Goodwill. And we provide a free personal nurse for pregnant moms throughout their pregnancy and until the child is 2 years old. The program provides a nurse who helps that mom with everything from what pregnancy is going to be like, how to have a good, healthy, nutritious diet, how to have a healthy baby, how to find an apartment if they're looking for housing, or how to find resources that they may need for transportation or for school. The focus is mainly to have a healthy pregnancy, a healthy baby, but to also help that mom become economically self-sufficient and to be able to have the best life that she can for her and her baby.
Now, how critical is it to have a program like this available for mothers here in Northwest Indiana?
It's extremely critical because we're in an area with multiple health disparities, including the high rate of preterm births and one of the highest rates of infant deaths before the age of 1 year old in the country. So there's other home visiting agencies, but ours is the only one that is specifically all nurses and also focuses on intensity of visits and making sure that we are training and helping that mom in multifaceted. It's important to... we don't take the place of any medical care. You know, we encourage the moms to keep their prenatal visits. As a matter of fact, most of our moms have a higher rate of keeping prenatal visits with their physicians. They also are better at making sure that they keep their babies at their visits, to their well baby visits after they deliver. So it's very critical in the health of the mom and the baby and the community.
Would you say those are probably the best benefits to note of the program?
You know what? There are many other benefits. This program has been shown, it's throughout the country, so it's in 43 other states, and it's been shown statistically since the 1970s when it implemented to transform the lives of vulnerable moms and babies and their families. And there are things that are a benefit to society, including things like a 46% reduction in infant mortality, a decrease of smoking during pregnancy by about 25%, and then, of course, all the illnesses that relate to that. A decrease in language delay for the children by about 40%, 33% less ER visits for childhood injuries, and a decrease in pregnancy-induced hypertension by about 32%, which is one of the leading causes of maternal mortality. So these are things that are costly and they impact the families greatly.
Now, Julia Cook-Jones, let's turn to you now, please. Tell us first a little bit about yourself.
Yes, hello. I am a Purdue Northwest student studying communication and public relations. I am currently a senior. I have my son November 6, 2017, and he is about to be 3 months on the 6th.
Wow, that's great. That's great. How did you become a client of the Nurse Family Partnership?
Well, I actually went to one of their events they were sponsoring, and I went over to the table. I wanted to know a little bit more about it, and I was hooked from then.
I know that you have some great people that are making up your support system to help get you through not only taking care of your newborn, but also getting yourself through through school, too, because I understand you went back to your studies at Purdue Northwest after you had your baby.
Yes.
There are probably a number of people that are close and help out, and maybe just friends that help out, too. But who are the people that you count on the most?
My nurse, Karen, and the staff at NFP. If it wasn't for them, I really don't know how I would have transitioned into being the parent I am today and my family. Without the help of NFP, my family wouldn't have this transition because my son is the last grandson, really. So they needed to prepare more don't have the baby, sleeping in the bed with pillows, don't feed them often. It's so much with parenting that old parents do not know about. So the babies are transformed, and so is parenthood. So they really helped me and guide me through that transition.
Now, what you've experienced with the Nurse Family Partnership, what would you say are the most benefits that you have seen from it?
The greatest benefit is knowing that I have someone other than my family and my friends to be that number one support system. So it's been times where I have to cry, and I cannot cry or vent to anyone, not even my friends, my family. But I know that my nurse Karen, will always be there for me and my son.
Now, what are your plans when you graduate from Purdue University Northwest? Have you made any yet?
Yes. When I graduate, I would like to pursue my master's, hopefully in a nonprofit-related field, and therefore I can go into, hopefully, Nurse Family Partnership, so I can grant the greatness that they have gave me and my son to other mothers and families that are in need.
Now let's turn back to you, Paulette. What are the qualifications that people might have to face to be able to be participants in this special program?
Sure. The mom has to be pregnant and enrolled in the program before the end of her 28th week of pregnancy. She has to have no prior live birth. She must live in, currently, our branch is only in Lake County.
Mm-hmm.
There are plans for expansion, but right now we only cover Lake County. And then she also has to be eligible for programs like WIC, Medicaid, TANF. They don't have to necessarily be in those programs, but just have the same income, meet the same income criteria. And, they can self-refer by contacting our office, which is 219-444-2000. Or they can be referred by their doctor, by the WIC program, by their case manager. We're making sure our information is at the township offices. Any place that they can go and get assistance, they will be able to get information about our program. And Chris, who wouldn't love to have their own free personal nurse during pregnancy and early childhood? As Julia mentioned, sometimes there are questions that you want to ask or things that you need to know that you don't want to feel judged, and so you don't go to your family, but you can go to your own personal nurse, and that person helps you work through problems, through sick baby days, through finding resources for jobs, through finding housing, getting out of a violent situation and helping you find shelter. So just all kinds of things. It's not just nursing program, a nursing program.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a holistic program.
Well, we've been talking with Paulette Maxey, who is the Director of Operations for the Nurse Family Partnership, which is a big program that's involved with the Goodwill Industries Central in Southern Indiana and the Goodwill Industries of Michiana, which, of course, we are a part of, as well as having with us to talk about the services and how it's personally helped her, a new mom, Julia Cook-Jones. Ladies, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate the information, and we hope that this program does grow and branches out to other counties here in Northwest Indiana soon.
Thank you so much.
The Indiana Senate approved legislation on Monday to allow anyone in the state to buy or sell cannabis oil, or CBD. The Senate's bill is similar to language that was approved last week by the House, meaning CBD legalization appears to have a clear path forward this session. Republican Senator Mike Young's bill legalizes CBD as a hemp extract, and he says it must have 0.3% or less THC. That's the ingredient that causes a high. And he says CBD has very few serious side effects.
But the benefits to this appear to be numerous. It can help people with conditions, especially people going through cancer, treatment for their pain.
But the bill's support is not unanimous. Republican Senator Gene Lysing notes that many states have legalized hemp production and sale, as well as CBD oil. But she says that the federal government still restricts these products.
If I said, I'm going to jump in the lake today, do you want to jump with me? But it's really cold. That wouldn't be very smart.
The Senate approved the bill, though, 35-13. A measure to provide some press freedoms to Indiana students failed to garner enough votes for passage on the House floor on Monday. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on the bill's demise as the House closed out the first half of its session.
Republican Representative Ed Clear's bill would prevent school officials from censoring student journalist content or disciplining students because of what they produce. But Clear says the bill does not provide free rein to students.
Everything that student journalists do is still subject to prior review by school officials.
And students wouldn't be allowed to produce anything that could, for instance, incite other students to violence or disrupt school activities. Still, Republican Representative Tony Cook, a former superintendent, says the bill erodes school leaders' authority.
You will have mass chaos in some of your schools. You'll have more students fighting and pitting against each other.
The House voted 47-45 for the bill, but legislation needs at least 51 votes to pass. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
At a for-profit nursing school's Central Indiana campus is trying to get more students interested in the field, which faces a shortage of qualified practitioners. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan spent some time with a few dozen high schoolers who very recently experienced a day in the life of a nurse.
A few dozen students from Indianapolis's Warren Central High School take part in a simulated disaster response at Chamberlain University College of Nursing. Junior Stefan Gaither says he has family members pursuing healthcare-related jobs.
That kind of inspired me, you know, I guess to go in the medical field and be like an EMT or something.
The Chamberlain program gives students a chance to get hands-on experience in a variety of simulations. Nurse and Chamberlain Indianapolis President Christopher Bell says the nursing workforce shortage is a growing issue.
And we talk about this all the time, about the shortage and how more and more nursing programs need to grow and get bigger and get the word out that we need more nurses in Indiana.
More than 20 schools offer nursing programs in Indiana, but there's a lack of faculty to train students. Indiana lawmakers are considering a bill to increase those numbers. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
And that's Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. Tomorrow on the program, we'll have a conversation with Urban League of Northwest Indiana President and CEO Dr. Vanessa Allen. Hope you'll join us for that.